So what are we doing again?
X-Men.
Spoilers?
Check.
Mature language?
Check.
Should listeners be advised?
Check.
The Marvel superheroes have arrived. The Avengers and America's
Fantastic Four.
Hulk. Spider-Man.
Iron Man.
Welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Luke Machine, and with me is
Diablo Frank
and Mr. Fix-It.
And today we're going to talk about the Uncanny X-Men.
So, Mac, just like in a nutshell, explain the concept of X-Men to like visiting aliens or like a young child or something that would somehow not be familiar with them.
Sure thing. The quote-unquote X-Men are a group of fucking, like, not mutated. Are they mutated? They got a,
no,
they got a gene, right? They got a gene.
Mutated
they're called, gene. I just know, mute. Is that PC anymore? I don't know. Whatever. Back in the 60s, we called them muties. Anyway, so they're just genetic offshoot of humans, and they have these wild, amazing powers. The X-Men were founded by a gentleman named Professor Xavier, and they named the team X-Men after him. He, as a mutant himself, decided to train and help teach these young mutants how to use their powers and, you know, kind of fight for the forces of good against the forces of evil while also helping them deal with, again, controlling their powers and how they live their lives as these young adults growing up in a world that is scared of them and fear them and
tries to kill them.
Et cetera, et cetera. Yes. Lots of racial parallels, you know, stuff like that. That's all I got.
Mac, chronologically, X-Men's chronology, what is the earliest story you can think of that you've read featuring the X-Men?
Dark Phoenix saga.
You,
No. What was before Dark Phoenix? What was the fucking one where Wolverine ends up in the sewer and he's covered in shit?
The same one.
Same one. Okay. That, yeah. Read all that.
Okay.
That's as far back as I go. I did not read this chronologically, obviously. I went back and read it, but.
Yeah. So you didn't have any like Avengers appearances, like, you know, Magneto turning up and fighting the Avengers or I think the Avengers and the X-Men had a mission together at one point in the early days. You didn't read any of that stuff?
I mean, I had X-Men versus Avengers, but didn't that take place after the Dark Phoenix?
No, I'm talking about like in the Silver Age.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, shoot. No, shit. I'm sorry. I was right the first time. I think, you know what? I don't know. When did the first time a mutie popped up in one of my Avenger books? I can't tell you offhand. I apologize.
How about you, Mr. Fix-It?
Oh, shit. No. Rogue. It has to be Rogue, right?
Oh,
Avengers Annual 8.
Yeah, but that was actually after, I think, Dark Phoenix Saga.
Was it after Dark Phoenix?
I think so, yeah. Okay. But what about you, Mr. Fix-It? What's the earliest X-Men comic book or featuring the X-Men comic you've read?
Probably something along the lines of The Fall of the Mutants.
You've read earlier than that. I mean, I'm not talking about the first time you ever read them yourself. I mean, going back into their history, the earliest stories you've read featuring the X-Men.
Oh, just like the original books that they came out? I think the first one where Mimic showed up.
So this was like the around the 20s or 30s?
Stan Lee run, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think Stan was already gone by then. I think Arnold
was
Drake
he?
Was doing it by then, yeah.
Okay. I believe Mimic one was the first one I ever read. Like, went out and sought out and found and read.
Just because you thought the power set was cool?
Well, yeah. Well, because Mimic just seemed cool. He had all the powers of the original X-Men. He had Beast, Angel, Cyclops. I think that's the first one I can remember reading because it looked really cool on the comic book on the shop's wall, and I bought that one. And when I started collecting was when Fall of the Mutants, definitely when the Brood story arc came out with Wolverine ingesting an egg of the Brood. I remember it really hooked me.
I didn't realize until deciding there was time for us to go ahead and cover the X-Men that I had never read the first issue of X-Men. And I started reading it, and I realized that my familiarity with those early issues of X-Men came from Marvel Saga. Do you guys remember that series?
Yes.
I do.
Describe it.
They would just do reprints of old stories. They would mix, what, like two or three comics in there?
It wasn't so much reprints of the cool comics. They would take a panel from a comic book, and then it'd be like dense text around those panels explaining what happened in a whole issue. But usually a comic book issue would be covered in a span of a few panels, and they were done chronologically based on when they were supposed to happen within the Marvel comics themselves. So even if you had something like the origin of Wolverine that would have taken place like before the Fantastic Four's mission, they would address that first. first, and then they'd go into the mission. So it took into account retroactive continuity and tried to tell the story of Marvel Comics from not necessarily its earliest days, but around when the company got started and some stuff that happened a little bit before that happened. So I remember that's how I knew the story. I'd never read X-Men Abroad before, and I tried to read it for this, and it's really fucking boring. And even though it's Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, it feels super phoned in. For starters, like when we went back and we read the origin of Iron Man, we're surprised how sophisticated it was and what a great job was done with that one. You know, we weren't expecting a lot out of it. And it turned out there's a reason why it made a great fucking movie, because it's a great fucking origin story. And then I look at X-Men number one, and the team's already there. And so you've got Xavier in his chair. It's the iconic image, and I'm sure you've all seen it, where Xavier's in his chair and the four male X-Men are rushing up to him. And they're rushing up to him because he's about to put them through his paces. He's got a prototype version of the Danger Room, where he's going to have them work out their powers and show what they can do. And he's constantly shouting, okay, you have 3 seconds to do this. You have 15 seconds to do this. And so you're immediately disliking Xavier because he's kind of a dick to his charges. And there's no real reason why. What do you guys think of Professor X? Tell me a little bit about what you know about that character.
He's
and your
a jerk.
About you're referencing the Kitty Pryde story where you got a splash page where it's all about her relationship with Professor X.
And he's a jerk.
I don't know. I don't have any impression of it. You know what? I don't remember a single line of Professor X dialogue in any X-Men comic book I've ever read in my entire life.
But what is his deal?
What is his deal?
Yeah, what does he do?
Oh, what he like his power? What he do?
I thought he was just the money.
Well, and it also had all like these CIA connections and shit too.
He provided the mansion. He provided the toys. He kind of gave them a guidance of which way he wants the team to go. But Cyclops kind of ran the team, and he kind of told Cyclops how he wanted the team ran. I mean, he ends up becoming Onslaught. I mean, a lot of bad shit comes from him.
Fucking spoiler. Jesus.
We'll jump ahead 35 years.
One. Legion is his father. Ooh,
no, it's Legion's his kid.
Oh, there you go. My bad. That's right. Legion's his kid.
Xavier's an interesting guy because he has those extraordinary telepathic powers. In the early issues, he has this nasty tendency where the X-Men would be fighting some villain, and he'll just kind of roll up in his wheelchair and then mentally turn off somebody's mind. And it's like, okay, X-Men, you can go put those guys away now. You know, I've taken care of it. And so they always had to come up with bullshit reasons why he doesn't just take care of all the problems himself. And obviously one of those bullshit reasons is he's in a wheelchair, you know, but that's not a really good reason. And I think that the thing about Xavier is he's sort of like the divorced dad who fucks. It's like you think he's like this pristine guy who's like really like austere, and he's like, you know, an unimpeachable character and shit. And he's just like a firm, stern disciplinarian and shit. And then years later, you find out that he actually kind of want to fuck the one of the young girls that was, you know, one of his students. And, you know, he went off and hung out with Magneto, this guy who was a Holocaust survivor. But he also kind of embraces fascism, and he ultimately becomes this mass murderer. And, you know, he decides, well, I'm going to hang out with this dude and play chess with him and shit, instead of like taking him out before he becomes a mass murderer. And like he knocks up a chick in Israel, and she ends up having this kid with multiple personality disorder who's got like a slew of different powers. Every personality has a different power, and so he's extremely powerful and extremely dangerous. And he just constantly, like you mentioned, the Dark Phoenix saga. You know, he's got one of his charges who's going to be killed, executed by this alien race because she's so powerful. She's a threat to the galaxy. And you know, again, he could just roll out and just shut everybody's minds down, but instead, he like lets his X-Men fight it out with the Shi'ar's Imperial Guardsmen and shit for the life of his charge. And the whole time, he's like hanging out with Lilandra, this princess who he ends up having this relationship with. And it's like, okay, yeah, the dude's in a wheelchair, and yet he's constantly with these hot babes. And so I've realized that he's got to be using the telepathy to be smashing these chicks. You know, sex is pretty much part of the mind, and so I'm figuring he's mentally fucking people like Lilandra the whole time his X-Men are out doing shit. And he's probably like this total like kink case.
Are you making him out to be a predator?
They during Mark Waid's run, in the lead up to Onslaught, they made a point of mentioning that he actually lusted after Jean Grey. And of course, one of the fucked up things about that is that he hobbled her powers because she was so powerful so young that he went in there and he put all these blocks in her powers. He decided how powerful she should be. Pretty fucked up, you know, shit when you read the subtext that way. I mean, since they're constantly talking about how, oh, the X-Men is this analog for racial tensions and shit, it's like, well, nobody asked you to do that. And I guess in the 60s, in comics, that's something you had to do in order to deal with those types of issues. You couldn't be, you know, you couldn't actually have black people and stuff and other people. But it's sort of like you look at Planet of the Apes, where it's like, okay, we're going to deal with a black struggle, but we're going to do it through British actors wearing monkey suits. You guys cool with that? And it's like, well, maybe in the time, but in retrospect, it's kind of fucked up. And maybe, you know, these aren't the people who should be telling those fucking stories. Well, Xavier's this guy. He's like, okay, well, I've decided how powerful you're going to be, Jean Grey. And who gave him that fucking authority? Well, apparently the X-Gene did.
It's like if you found out that Splinter from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was actually like a Vietnam vet with PTSD who was like trying to jerk off the Ninja Turtles when they were young in their bedrooms and shit like that.
A little bit.
I thought Casey Jones was that one. Isn't that? Aren't you describing Casey Jones?
What? Casey Jones? No, but Splinter's the leader. You think of him as this being this noble leader, and then you turn find out he's a Vietnam vet with PTSD who's trying to molest the turtles because they're teenaged. No.
I see where you're going with it. I definitely
was a very strange world.
I'm seeing the parallels. I see where you're going with it.
But he didn't. But you're saying Professor X in a lot of ways did.
Kind of, sort of. Yeah, he's kind of.
And people swipe it. They sweep it under the rug.
But at the same time, this guy is definitely an iconic figure because, like, he, generally speaking, he kind of looks like Lex Luthor, but nobody's ever going to confuse him with Luthor because he's got such distinctive facial features and the eyebrow and, of course, being in a wheelchair. But it's interesting how...
Glossed over that.
But nobody ever confuses Xavier with Lex Luthor, despite them looking alike. I think that he is actually one of the more distinctive characters in comics.
He's always been portrayed as the Martin Luther King of mutants.
I think that's what he's supposed to be. Sure, yeah.
The peace bringer, the pacifist. You know, he doesn't take the war to them. It's all about defense.
That's what it was, right? He was supposed to be MLK and Magneto.
Yeah,
was
Magneto
was
more like Malcolm X. Yeah.
Well, why don't you guys talk a little bit about Magneto? Where did you first encounter him?
It's got to be, you know what? It's got to be cartoons, right? That's probably where I started with all this stuff, is all the cartoons.
For me, it's the Brotherhood.
Secret Wars.
Days of Future Past, maybe?
X-Men versus Avengers. He had a big part in that one, too. That's got to be where I first encountered Magneto, as I called him when I was a child.
Same here. I had to be taught Magneto. I said Magneto, too. That's the most obvious route for a kid. So what is his deal? Tell us a little bit about Magneto, and what do you think about the dude?
It's a bad dude, but also...
Way cooler.
You kind of understand it. You know, you kind of get it.
Wasn't there t-shirts around that used to say Magneto was right?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I remember somebody wearing one time and said Magneto was right. So
you know what? And let me just say this for a second. I don't know if it's going to steer us in the wrong way, but you know what? That's kind of a real failure of the X-Men movies, is because I never hear anybody say, nobody ever sympathized with Magneto like they sympathized with Thanos. Well, they totally should have if those movies were done correctly, right?
He should be.
He had the intro to the X-Men movies. I remember watching the X-Men movies.
I mean, his small scene
of him, you know, the Nazis dragging him off and he's tearing down the gates to get to his family.
Yeah, that's cool.
I thought was really deep, and then the rest of the movie was just kind of what it was.
But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, if they really did him right, I feel like you're supposed to have that. Shit, is Magneto fucking right? Are the X-Men the assholes? Like, but I don't feel like they never did that.
In the books, they did a little bit.
Well, no, I know the books. I'm talking about the movie. Maybe I didn't specify that.
I always found it interesting that he was a Holocaust survivor. So he had that perspective of, you know, never again, and, you know, whatever it takes. Where Xavier was kind of, I don't know, I just never been a big fan of Professor X. He was, you know, the money, I guess.
Well, I think one of the problems with Professor X is that they've made the Martin Luther King parallel in the past, but he's not the actual MLK. He's the version that politicians try to sell you on now. He's this guy who's always like kind of working close with the government and willing to like kind of suppress his own mutants and hide his own mutants so that they're not inconvenient, you know, to them. And of course, he sends his mutant strike force against Magneto, this guy who's overtly trying to prevent forces that are actively trying to exterminate, you know, mutant kind. There's especially over the course of the series, X-Men series, you have more and more forces that get built up with the express purpose of committing genocide against his people, and Xavier's kind of working with the government to be like the cool mutie who's gonna, like, you know, cut a deal or something. So when you look at it from that perspective, you know, Magneto's like the Eric Killmonger of the mutants, and if they conveyed that correctly, if they hadn't demonized them to such a degree and actually played out the politics that they're trying to set forth with the so-called MLK Malcolm X example, he would not only be more sympathetic, but you have to question whether or not, really seriously have to question whether or not he was right, especially as things escalate and there's a greater effort to kill all of his kind.
Yeah, and so I don't know if it's a sign of the times that you have more people siding with Thanos or Eric Killmonger in these movies, and you know, Magneto is just obviously the bad guy in the X-Men movies. Like, again, maybe if they reboot that stuff in the MCU, you'll kind of start to see this ambiguity, and people will be more willing to take Magneto's side and be vocal about it. But I, in my memory of just an X-1, Magneto is just obviously a bad dude. Like, he's just obviously the bad guy, and that's really not, if that's where you're starting, you're already kind of screwing up the X-Men from my understanding of whatever made the X-Men cool. Right? Wrong? Right? Wrong?
No, I agree.
Okay, back to the comic books. Sorry to get us on that movie rant.
Okay, so let's talk about the X-Men. The, probably the most iconic X-Man, at least from the early days, was Scott Slim Summers. Tell me a little bit about him.
You want to take this one, fix it?
I shoots lasers out of his ruby visor to, you know, go in depth like his brother's Havoc, and they can't hurt each other because apparently they both project the same power, which I never quite understood where their power came from. He's in love with Jean Grey obsessively, has a thing for redheads apparently, because it happens quite a few times where he's either banging Jean Grey or a Jean Grey lookalike, though he did have a small run with Storm, I believe.
Really? I don't know about that. I know that he definitely has a thing for telepaths.
Didn't they allude
to
it like they were having a relationship when she was in her mohawk phase?
No, definitely not in the mohawk phase. Nah, those guys were almost straight up enemies at that point, because he was like, Johnny, I was the co-founder of the X-Men, I should be leading the team, and she's like, I've been leading the team, your time to go, you got to get out of here. They had a fight for the leadership of the X-Men, so no, definitely not romantic.
That cover, there's one where he's blasting and she's in the corner kind of jumping. I thought they didn't they have like a relation, or no, maybe I'm thinking Forge.
Yes, you are thinking of Forge definitely had a relationship with Storm. That's like her number one bow. So yeah, but he also clearly has things with telepaths, because before he married Jean Grey, he kind of flirted with the possibility of hooking up with Psylocke, and then, you know, later on he got full on shacked up with the Emma Frost, the White Queen, this reformed,
Did he date what's her name, the one that the Demon Queen, or
Madeline Pryor? She was married to her. That was his wife.
Yeah, but and of course, she like a clone of Jean or something.
She was a clone of Jean created by Mr. Sinister because of some of the slights that were perpetuated against her during their marriage. She was seduced by a demon named Sim to become the Goblin Queen and full on, you know, retaliate against her husband and his wayward ways. So what do you guys think about Cyclops, though?
I think Cyclops is annoying, but is, I mean, you gotta have that guy, right? You gotta have him. Doesn't he keep things interesting by being so, you know, I think his personality in the group is strangely valuable to making compelling stories. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, because to some degree, if you look at the first issue of X-Men, all the guys have sort of kind of the same personality. He really does stand out because he is the stiff, kind of like teacher's pet, but also, you know, field leader, determined, straight arrow. Actually, to some degree, it's the absence of personality, the absence of charisma that defines him, because he's just like such a straight shooter, no pun intended.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, later on with Wolverine and Jean Grey and all that stuff, I think all that stuff is way, you don't have all that without Scott. And I think that's all like, you know, that's some iconic conflict within the X-Men, and you don't have it without Scott. So as much as people kind of shit on the guy, and, you know, maybe deservedly so some, but again, the fact that he's there for you to shit on him means that he has, I think that gives him purpose, which is kind of a weird purpose.
He's kind of a ball breaker too with the team. He was always pushing him to train, and he was obsessed with getting Xavier's
approval.
What do we call it? Approval, yeah. Like, almost like a fatherly approval. So, I mean, that kind of made him a little dynamic in the book.
Well, I mean, Ryan Daly changed my perspective somewhat on Cyclops, because I tend to think of him as the stiff that would get into arguments with Wolverine. Of course, I was like team rebel, team badass. But he pointed out that this dude was a orphaned young, or presumed orphaned young. He pretty much had to raise himself. And, you know, when you're in those kind of dire circumstances where you're growing up in an orphanage and you've got no resources, and then, of course, he has this mutant power manifest where he can't fucking look at people without blowing them apart, and has to, you know, go to, I think it's Xavier who devised the way for him to actually control those beams, because without his ruby quartz visor, he's just constantly blasting lasers out of his eyes. This is a guy who desperately needs a father figure, and Xavier controls his powers, gives him a purpose, gives him a home, is the first father figure he's had since he was a younger boy, and it's all about, you know, pleasing this father figure, and that character makes a lot more sense when you look at it in those terms.
Ooh, I like that. That is a different layer.
Plus, he was pretty awesome in Marvel versus Capcom.
Yeah, he's pretty good in the game.
Dude, Optic Blast, one of my favorite moves.
Yeah.
But there is another thing, though, with Cyclops, is that it seems to me like a lot of people that like the original X-Men, he was like their Mr. X-Man, their favorite character, including John Byrne, who was a pivotal artist in X-Men, one of the most popular artists to ever do the characters, helped popularize them, and of course became a superstar and a hugely influential creator, but also had major tension with Chris Claremont, the primary writer associated with X-Men in their most dynamic days, and they had a pretty acrimonious falling out. And it seemed to me that, you know, once John Byrne wasn't there, and of course he was clearly had his preference for Cyclops, it almost seemed like Claremont intentionally demonized that character because he had him do all sorts of sordid shit afterwards that really tainted the views of people toward that character, especially of our generation, since that was those prime years where he's doing fucked up shit, like, again, shacking up with a clone of Jean Grey, having a baby with her, and then as soon as Jean Grey shows back up again, he deserts them in Alaska to fend for themselves, and they get attacked by a sentinel, and all this fucked up shit happens to them, and eventually his ex-wife comes back on him, and after a fight, she apparently dies, and they go in the original version of her gets to raise her son, you know, as her own and shit.
Turns out to be
a Cable. Yes. Yeah, goes to the far future, infected with a techno virus, and then eventually comes backwards in time. You know, I didn't
spoilers,
catch what was that?
Spoilers.
Yeah, about the spoilers here, clearly. Another thing that gets me too is I think that demonization certainly impacted on me because I'm a big fan of Dick Grayson, Nightwing. And one of the reasons why I love that character.
Never fucking heard of him.
Yeah, I never knew that about you, man.
You didn't know I like Nightwing?
I've heard this.
Really? Nah, no. That doesn't make sense. Okay. So anyway, I loved the new Teen Titans, and I loved his role in it, and he very, very much has a Cyclops-like role. But the difference is he just continues to be that rigid team leader, but he's also kind of young, and so he makes mistakes, and so he's a little bit more fallible than, say, Batman, his mentor. But they never demonize him, and so I like that character, whereas I have all these problems with Cyclops, and I think a lot of it has to do with the character flaws and the personality flaws that were ingrained in him by Chris Claremont, who may have intentionally been going after this guy because of John Byrne's love of the character. Big-time spoilers, Cyclops eventually turns to the side of Magneto and becomes this, you know, literally like a demonized figure who's, you know, hated for the damage he does to mutant kind because of his betrayal of Xavier's principles.
I haven't read anything recent, but I've picked up a few things here and there. For a while there, he was a villain, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think he actually died. I think he might actually still be dead.
How many times has he died already, man?
Yeah. Well, it's very complicated, too. We'll deal with that a little bit later, though. Let's talk about Angel. What can you tell me about Warren Worthington III?
All I know about the Angel is from the Marvel Universe Handbook. Tune in to the Marvel Universe Handbook where Diablo Frank and Mr. Fixit discuss Angel. Right? Didn't you guys talk about that shit like a week ago? Yeah.
Did we do Angel together?
It's been a while.
Yeah, because I was like, I was surprised at how in-depth the two of you went in it, and it was just like, I was very proud of the two of you. Just keeping it real right now. Yeah, it's how you want to. Very proud of you, too.
Thank you. I preferred him when he was Archangel.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, and I stand by my
I think you jumped right for that, too.
I stand by my statement.
So actually, that being the case, then, I really need to hear a little bit more from Mac, then, because we don't know Mac's views of this guy.
I agree with Mr. Fixit. No, I'm just joking. Angel was always seemed super lame to me, dude. You just fly around. Like, talk about the most basic superhero shit. And you know, Archangel was definitely the cooler looking of the two, and he did get a little more street cred, especially for the night. He looked badass in the 90s when everybody was just fighting to make yourself look more badass than the other character. He looked badass. And, you know, one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Like, this is all much cooler shit than, what's his name, Warren Worthington III floating around with, you know what I mean? And wasn't he like the pretty boy with money too? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Horribly unlikable character.
Yeah, and again, the wings are a problem because the wings don't retract. So you automatically have to have this whole situation where he has to strap down his wings against like his thighs and stuff when he's walking around so that people don't see his fucking wings.
Then, as you said, the X-Factor, didn't he have like a big backpack he would always be putting on?
Yeah, well, they did the whole thing where they were basically the Ghostbusters. They pretended to hunt mutants when they're actually collecting mutants to help them train.
He had like a backpack. He was always running around with this giant backpack. I thought it looked so goofy.
His proton pack on his back, and he's strapped. But yeah, it's like when you think about the physics of it too, you know, bird wings aren't the best thing to, you know, if you're going to fly, there's all these people who fly unaided, you know, just because they just up and fly. And so when you think about the physics of a guy who's got wings, like, well, birds have like hollow bones and shit. They're really lightweight. That's why they're able to, you know, hoist themselves up in the air and shit. So wouldn't this guy be weaker than the average person? It's like, and again, because he's propelled by his wings, it's like, okay, all you have to do is target the wings and this guy goes down. There's this extended bit that it happens twice in the first issue of X-Men. I think it really jinxed the character, where he's like doing the danger room sequence and he needs to be saved because all he can do is fly away from shit. And what especially got me is later on when he fights Magneto, Magneto launches these missiles at the X-Men. And so Beast is like just using acrobatics to jump away around the missiles and they just fly by him and that's it. For some reason, the missiles are able to target Angel, and so he's just trying to fly away from them and all the other X-Men have to save him from the missiles that are locked in on him. So he never even actually saves himself, and he's already got like the most basic power, because so many characters, like you look at somebody like Superman, if Superman can't fly, he's not really Superman. But he also, if he can't lift up heavy shit, he's not Superman, because he's got to have the super strength too, or he's not really Superman anymore. And then with Angel, there are so many characters who have the power of flight, who have a better version of the power of the flight, a version that makes more sense, that yeah, it's really hard to get behind this character. And it seems to me like the only reason why he was even in the book is because there was a kind called Angel in the 40s. There's like a vigilante character, and I think they were just recycling the name, and he's the most obvious way of representing that. But it took 30-40 years before they finally figured out something to do with him, because his whole thing was, after he left the X-Men, he was in the Champions and he was in the New Defenders, and the role was always, I'm the guy who flies and I pay the bills because I'm rich. So it's hard to get behind
him.
Like,
didn't he always carry somebody to a battle or something like that?
I mean occasionally, yeah, but that's the thing. Okay. He'd take an effective member.
He was the Uber of mutants.
Yeah, and he'd transport them, you know? It's like, is that all you got? And it's funny too, because he was the icon that they had above the X-Men logo for years, and I think it might have actually turned people away from the book rather than attracting them to it.
Well, until he became Archangel. I still think, you know, those images of him with the helmet with the skull on it and those rows and rows of razor-sharp wings behind him are a great image. That's the Angel I'm always going to think of.
Just turning his skin blue, it automatically makes him multiple times cooler. Just as simple as that. Just that one thing makes a difference.
Agreed. Excellent point about the blue skin.
So let's talk about Beast. Matt could probably carry this since he's got maybe a little bit more familiar with Beast than he would any of the other X-Men.
I thought this was an X-Men podcast, not an Avengers podcast, you guys. No, I'm just kidding. Do you want to know where my most probably the first Beast story I ever read was in Marvel Comics Presents? Oh, wasn't he doing? He was doing backup Marvel Comics Presents.
Wasn't that Rob Liefeld? Or did you get one of the Jay Lee ones?
Bro, I don't know. It sounds more like Jay Lee. I don't think it was Rob Liefeld.
Well, it was actually started by Rob Liefeld, and of course he couldn't keep up with the schedule, and he had the shit he wanted to do. I think he was working his way towards the big changes in New Mutants. He was doing that as like a side gig. So when he left, Jay Lee took it over, and that was like the first thing Jay Lee really did at Marvel.
Internet save us! But I just remember the story, like he was dating some nurse, and she got murdered, and he was trying to figure out. Okay, Marvel Comics Presents number 85 to 92.
Are you talking about Fatal Attraction?
Oh, that was later then. That's probably after the story I was thinking of.
It was both Rob Liefeld and Jay Lee.
Oh, it was that late in the run?
91.
Yeah. Wow. No, like the year 91, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't realize the book had got. I mean, it was a bi-weekly book. I guess they got the numbers up quicker than I thought.
So it says Rob Liefeld co-penciled the first two parts only. The rest are fully penciled by Jay Lee. Don Hudson helps ink issue 89 only. Liefeld apparently mentioned in the story. He mentioned the story in an interview in Marvel Age while before this was published, and he just handed the unfinished project off to Jay Lee rather than doing the actual collaboration. Yeah, so this was my first like full on. I was a big Marvel Comics Presents guy, so which will tie into Wolverine too. And really, this stuff, I don't think any of this shit really had anything to do with the X-Men, did it? I don't think that this story had anything to do. Maybe it did. I don't remember. But yeah, I just remember that he had like a nurse who was like his girlfriend, and she gets murdered in it, and it was like super gory. The page where she dies is super gory, and I was like, whoa, made an impression on me. That's it. That's all I got. Beast. Also, just everybody loves the Beast in the Avengers. He's badass.
Well, okay.
He's a comic.
Explain who Hank McCoy is, though. Like, who is this guy? What is his thing?
Hank McCoy's a doctor. He turned a big furry blue dude. That's about it.
Well, he was already a big dude, like muscular dude with big hands and big feet that gave him like extra agility and shit like that. And then he was the guy who was most overt. He could not hide his mutant abilities. So even more so than Angel, he was really out there and he didn't want to be. And so he was in such denial about his mutantism that he actually tried to concoct a solution to take it away from himself, And instead, he sprouted blue fur all over himself and became more literally a beast in a series of solo stories from the 70s.
And, fun fact, can't believe I forgot this part, my first child, very large when he was born, huge hands, huge feet. And when he was born, Frank came to the hospital and said, he's a fucking beast. Your wife gave birth to Hank McCoy, and we both had a very long laugh about it, because I think I had slept maybe 25 minutes for the prior 3 days. It was excellent. He's beast. He's fucking Hank McCoy. Good times.
So what about you, Mr. Fix-It? What's your relationship to the character?
I really remember reading a story where him and Iceman are chasing down a mutant who has the ability where she kisses people and they mutate into like these.
The Simonsons did that, right? And they're like the some yes. Like early days. Yeah,
that's the one I really remember reading, because it has that great cover where I think she's on the cover and they're dangling like earrings from her ears or something like that.
Yeah, well, I think she was in a couple of covers. I think one of them was spotlight on her kissing them, and then another was the one with the earrings. But also that was during a period of time where. Beast had managed to stop being blue and furry, but at the and he'd become more had become stronger. But his brain, this guy's a genius. I don't know if he's a biologist, he had a genius intellect. But his big thing is like, was it biology or chemistry?
Everything, both? Dude. Poetry. I mean, he was
well. But the whole thing is he managed to stop being furry again, but he was becoming increasingly less intelligent. Dumb. And it wasn't like Maul and Wildcats where it kind of came and went. It's like he was like progressively getting worse, almost like an Alzheimer's situation.
And one of the funny thing is, so I like Beast, but I've always liked Dark Beast that was later on introduced, because it's like a version of Beast if he didn't give a fuck. Like,
well,
he was
it should
bastard.
Be pointed out he's from an alternate timeline where Xavier was killed and the era of the mutants was defined by one of the great nemeses of the mutants, Apocalypse.
Yes, and Dark Beast was introduced, and I always found the flip side of both of them very strange, where Beast is kind of the lovable beast on the Marvel version is this lovable beast. He's, he's quoting Shakespeare. He's bouncing around. He's smart. He always has the right thing to say. He's hanging upside down reading a book with glasses, which always was cool. He was just like the fun guy. And then you get Dark Beast and you have the darker version of him that if he had gone that route was really, because he's so fucking smart that he's always creating plans and, messing with genetics. And so it was interesting. So I like Beast. I've always found him as a fun character.
And see, I think we have to get back to Mac with this too. All the X-Men at various points in time, particularly because the original members had split off in the 1970s and they weren't really in the X-Men books as much. And a lot of these guys got trials as solo characters or another team. And, Beast had a somewhat successful run in Amazing Adventures. It wasn't gangbusters, but it lasted a little while. And then, of course, he moved on. He was in the Defenders at one point in the 80s, but the big thing was he joined the Avengers. And he was actually like a guy who, for a long time, there was probably better known as an Avenger than he ever had been as an X-Man. Did you encounter Beast in those, days?
Yeah. All the Perez stuff. He's there through all the Perez stuff. And is one of the more, he's the comic relief. So yeah, everybody loves Beast. Beast is great. He's kind of like the he's the X-Men's thing.
Yeah, but he's also,
because he's not so broody and whiny about the way he looked.
No, I know. But I mean, he translates into other books just better than everybody else.
Well, he's very recognizable.
Right. But the Thing can carry his own book. Like Invisible Woman, Human Torch, Mr. Fantastic can't. Or Mr. Fantastic, sorry, I can't talk, cannot. Whereas the Beast can do that. He can do Marvel Comics Presents. He can go and become an Avenger. I feel like the Beast, for some reason, has a little more depth as far as where he fits in the Marvel Universe than all these other characters. And I don't fucking know why. But he's sort of like the ever-loving blue-furred Beast. He just, everybody loves him.
He was always looking for love.
Yeah, well, of course, now, okay, we're talking about like my era of comic books. Yeah. Now I understand everybody's a fucking Avenger. But back then, it was like, holy shit, he's an X-Men and an Avenger? Like, this is super, it's weird. Now it's not that big a deal. But back then, it was a big deal, and he fit in great, and he was part of a really good run of Avengers. So,
That was back when there was a real prestige to being an Avenger, and now, like you said, everybody gets the fucking card.
Yeah. And it doesn't go the other way. I mean, Tony Stark's not going to be a fucking X-Men.
Right. Yeah. Not a two-way street.
He's going to be a Guardian of the Galaxy, maybe.
Well, they actually tried that. They had this thing called Uncanny X-Men, if I remember. No, sorry. Uncanny Avengers, I think it was. And they tried to intermingle the two teams, and it just never really worked. work. It's just it was two things that didn't combine well. It never should have been together in the first place, and it was really apparent when they actually did it. But one thing that's interesting with Beast 2 is he had this friendship with Simon Williams, the Wonder Man, and as a DC guy, one of the most beloved buddy comedy duos is Blue Beetle and Booster Gold. But probably a full decade before that, you had Beast and Wonder Man going off and having adventures and being the two buddies on their book. And I think that influenced buddy comedy in comics, that particular pairing.
Good call. Yeah, I totally forgot about Wonder Man. Again, like this, look how versatile this character is. How the hell did he just end up all over the Marvel Universe? This is so bizarre. Yeah, compared to all these other dudes who just, it never, I mean, Wolverine is the exception, obviously, but all these other X-Men are freaking, like, you're X-Men. That's who you are. Whereas I feel like Beast is just, for some reason, like the Thing, could cross, had all this over other crossover popularity.
Well, and you mentioned the Thing, too, and in that very first story, it's weird because they haven't figured out who he is yet. So he's actually rather thuggish, and he kind of sexually harasses somebody in the issue. It's like, really, Beast? Where he's much better known in later appearances as the guy who's very verbose and has an extraordinary vocabulary, and he's the kind of guy who's never going to use a 10-cent word. We're going to give you a $5 word instead, and having his little goofy sayings and such. And it's weird because I think they actually damaged that character when they decided that the X-Men didn't need a Thing anymore. They needed a Mr. Fantastic. And so they made him like the brains of the X-Men, and he was constantly in this role of being their scientist and their like government negotiator and stuff, kind of replacing Professor X in that capacity. And I don't think he's been nearly as popular since then because they decided to make him less humanoid. He became, his image looks more like the original version of Beauty and the Beast, the French version, where he's more cat-like, and he's constantly stuck in a lab or in a government meeting, and so the character just isn't as winning anymore because they don't let him be the Beast that we all knew and loved at one time.
Right on.
And so we get to the final X person. She is the last to join the team. It's one of the reasons why I think this first issue of X-Men is not one that really resonates with people, because again, it starts with all the team already together, and then this one new member comes in, Jean Grey, and it is a pattern we've seen a number of times in X-Men media, where a girl comes in to join the group, and she's sort of given a sense of, you know, what here we're going to use you as an opportunity to explain what we're doing and how we do it and all that kind of stuff. And so that person is Jean Grey, and so she shows up. She really doesn't even know why she's been sent to the Xavier School for gifted people, and it's, oh, because you're a mutant, honey, and we're going to give you this uniform. And it's funny because she's like, oh, this is such a sophisticated uniform, such a gorgeous uniform. And I personally think that the X-Men costume is like the ugliest fucking costume in comic books. The black and yellow bumblebee suit. What do you guys think of that fucking thing?
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
I didn't particularly care for it.
And they all had to fucking wear this shit, too. And
well, Cyclops had a cool costume. Isn't that one where he had the head cover?
Well, he had the skull cap. But they in the early days, they kind of all had it. He was the guy who mostly kept his costume, or he mostly kept the original suit. And because he's like the schoolboy, I think it works for him where it doesn't really work for the other characters, especially Jean Grey. She looks terrible.
Well, especially when you compare it to the other notable team that has like the uniform, which would be the Fantastic Four, which their original costumes are fantastic. No pun intended. With the four, and then you have like sort of the white collar and the white, you know what I mean, it works so well. And then you look at the X-Men's and they are pretty crappy. It kind of makes sense why they've changed uniforms a million times over.
And of course, she had the power of telekinesis initially. Later on, she had a telepathy, and again, I think it was because of blocks Xavier gave her. But what do you think about her as a character and her impact in comics in general?
Mr. Fix-It.
I thought you were gonna go first.
I mean, I can go. Look, I don't have time. I mean, look, for her, she's kind of like a character like Scarlet Witch for me, where she's just like, you just spend all your time telling me how incredibly powerful she is, that it kind of gets a little tired after a while, where I just feel like there's just so many stories that revolve around Jean Grey being the most powerful person on the planet. It makes me a little tired. But beyond that, I honestly, like, her actual personality traits, other than being somebody who Cyclops, like, I know Cyclops' personality. I know Wolverine's personality. I know Beast's personality. I don't really know if I know Jean Grey. And that may just be, again, I was an Avenger guy. I did not read a lot of X-Men books, so I'm definitely not trying to shit on the character. I'm just saying, personally, I don't have a lot of, there are not a lot of memorable moments like, oh yeah, that's a total Jean Grey thing. Like, like, oh yeah, when she sassed off to so-and-so, that's a Jean Grey move right there, dude. Like, I don't have that in my head.
I mean, she was a Dark Phoenix, and the was it the Black Queen, and she always seemed fractured. Like, they didn't know who she was. She was whoever they needed for the story. So I kind of agree with you. I don't know who Jean Grey is either.
Yeah, I agree with all both of you guys, because she's always kind of been the girl, and so she's like the girl that the guys want to be with, and she's the girl who co-founded the X-Men, and she's, you know, but in terms of like her having a life of her own, ideas of her own, goals of her own, she's the X-Men girl. She's Marvel girl.
Yeah.
Right. Like, is that weird? Because she's such a pivotal character in all these stories.
Yeah. She's always defined by some external thing, a power that she acquires, or who's in love with her, or, you know, what the mission is.
She can't control her powers, and she's always freaking out.
And that kind of comes later, you know, but yeah, exactly.
But it gets old really fast with her.
Yeah. And, you know, the more easily forgettable one, I would say, because he was already on the team, but I completely missed him, and that's been the case for most of his existence for me. Bobby Drake, Iceman, who, it's weird because in the earlier stories, he basically turns into Frosty the Snowman and with, you know, Cavalier boots on, and somebody thought that that was going to be something that kids were going to gravitate towards. I'm sure part of it was that you had the Human Torch, and they were looking to do, well, we've got a fire guy, so we'll do an ice guy. But in reading that first X-Men story, it's weird because he's a couple years younger than everybody else. They make a point of saying that he's 16, and it's weird too because there's a thing where all the guys are hot for Jean Grey when she first shows up. It's especially weird when Beast is all a business and getting all Joe Biden with her and shit, actually fucking kisses her, and she uses her powers to kind of, you know, put him in his place and shit. And then you've got Bobby's like not really into the girls, and like decades later they decided that they were going to retroactively make him the gay one. And it's funny because it's kind of there in that very first issue, because he's the only guy who's really not that into the girl that shows up at that point. Has been an all-boys school for apparently some time, since these guys have to be at least 18 years old. They've probably been training for quite a while there.
First of all, not gonna let the Joe Biden thing slide. You dropped that in, that was hilarious. Two, you're right. I guess I didn't ever thought about that this was like an all-boys school until she showed up. I've never ever thought about that before in my life. Mr. Fix It.
Yes.
I don't know, do you want to talk anymore about Marvel Girl, Miss Marvel, Marvel Girl slash Jean Grey slash Iceman. Dark Phoenix,
Goblin Queen. I enjoyed them in the
My bad. Adventure holy Crush. Shit, I totally forgot we're talking about Jean Grey.
You already forgot about him, man. Damn, that was fucking meta.
Sorry. I know. Yeah, I know Iceman from Spider-Man. I know. I know about Iceman from Spider-Man and the Amazing Friends, and that's fucking
it. I figured that was your first exposure too, right, Fix It?
Yeah, pretty much. The cartoon. I didn't know who he was up to the cartoon.
For folks who've never seen
that, I mean, he was him and Beast kind of palled around for a while, didn't they?
Sort of. But okay, tell us a little bit. There are people who don't know what this cartoon is. Why don't you tell them a little bit about what the cartoon is?
It's an old cartoon where Spider-Man, Firestarter, and Bobby Drake, Iceman are college students by day, crime fighters by night. My understanding was it was supposed to be Spider-Man, Iceman, and the Human Torch, but at the time the Human Torch was being used, so they created Firestarter for it.
Well, no, I'm going to say, I think you're getting her confused with the Prodigy song. It's Firestar.
Or Drew Barrymore, one of the two.
Firestarter.
Who said Firestarter?
Well, I always thought she was supposed to be from that Stephen King movie, or which one is it?
Firestorm, yeah, Drew Barrymore, where the little kid who's got the pyrokinetic powers, what they like to call it. With her,
What does she say? She says, stop it! And then everything catches on fire, water boils, walls explode.
Well, they eventually establish that Firestar actually has microwave powers, so that's why she doesn't burst into flames like the Human Torch does. Gives her a little bit of
variety. Firestar? I always thought it was Firestarter.
No, Firestar.
Oh, wow, for real. To this moment, I always thought her name was Firestarter.
Well, and I'll tell you this, when I was a kid, because she looked so much like Mary Jane Watson, I was trying to figure out how Mary Jane Watson got fire powers, you know? I always struggle with that. And it's also funny, too, because they would occasionally play around with, you know, Spider-Man's dating her or Iceman's dating her, but it always seemed like a bit of a put-on with Iceman. So it's funny. I think that meta-text was always sort of there, and we just overlooked it all those years. By the way, I did not know this. There's only like 24 episodes of that show, Spider-Man.
It didn't run very long.
Yeah.
Really?
But it ran three seasons, but one of the seasons is only three episodes long, and among those episodes, hold on one second.
You queuing up for the Prodigy?
Has that awesome haircut where it's like shaved in the middle with his two sides sticking out like Bobo the Clown?
Yeah, didn't he die recently?
Did he?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
The Prodigy guy, or one of the Prodigy dudes died. Yeah, I think he died. Which
was it in a fire?
Prodigy guy died.
Was it in a fire?
Keith Flint passed away in 2019. Yeah, that was that guy.
Oh, was it? Yeah, what did he pass away of?
Oh man, let's see. Death. Internet.
else?
Instance to conclude a suicide verdict.
Oh, shit.
We're going to say unknown. Possible overdose. I think that's probably what it was. Was it overdose or suicide? We don't know.
I've seen his haircut. I'm going to go with overdose.
Yeah, right.
The second season of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was only 3 episodes. I think 2 of them were about telling the backstory of who Firestar is and who Iceman is. And so, of course, they did flashbacks to the early days of the X-Men for Bobby. And with Firestar, she came in when there was another group of people, so they got to introduce some of the more popular X-Men. But certainly, for me, probably one of the first exposures to the concept of the X-Men would have been Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Also, I was looking, there was a subscription ad that had Beast in his shitty costume, the original X-Men costume, where I think he's either lifting something heavy or balancing on something heavy. And so I remembered seeing him. And also, there was an ad for the all-new, all-different X-Men, which we'll talk about in just a bit, where it showed like the original team versus the more modern team. And so I remember seeing those house ads when I was a kid. So between those three things, but certainly most prominently as far as introducing me to the concept of the X-Men was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, especially because when I was a kid, X-Men really wasn't on the stands because this was not a very popular book for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so it was cartoons that gave me that exposure I wouldn't have had otherwise. I also, I used to watch the Marvel Super Heroes, which took panels of comic books and animated them very badly. It was done back in 1966.
I saw those on VHS.
Yeah, and they used to run them on, I think, 39 when we were kids. And because they didn't have the rights to the Avengers team, they replaced them with the X-Men for one or two of those cartoons.
Say that one more time? Were you asking a question or were you making a statement?
No, I was making a statement. Is for some reason, I think they lacked the rights to the Avengers for the cartoon, for the purposes of the cartoon, like licensing or something. It's either the Avengers or maybe the Fantastic Four, which actually would probably make more sense. So they replaced them with the X-Men in that story, that barely animated story.
Gotcha.
I got 2 questions. Was Firestar a mutant, and did she ever get rolled over into the Marvel Universe?
Yes and yes. Firestar was created for the cartoon, probably to replace Human Torch, as mentioned, because there's a long established history in the comics of Spider-Man and Human Torch being buddies. No such relationship with Iceman. It was all about, I guess, paralleling Human Torch's powers. And so she was created for the show. I think that's why she looked like Mary Jane. And because they wanted to have that synergy, Jim Shooter, who was running Marvel at the time, was really big on trying to maintain a united front in terms of how characters were represented in the media and in the comics. And so they actually did a 4-issue miniseries where they introduced Firestar into the Marvel Universe. And then, of course, Mac, as an Avengers fan, had several years of Firestar as an Avenger.
Did I? When was she a fucking Avenger? I don't remember this.
The Kurt Busiek, George Perez run in the, like, oh, the Heroes Return.
Oh, right.
She's in that awful...
Post Heroes Reborn.
Yeah. She was in her shitty New Warriors costume. I think it was New Warriors. Like she had a jacket or some shit and black and red costume. It was one of those things like you really love these iconic Avengers and they just kept foisting these lousy, you know, side characters on you like Justice and Firestar.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, no. That's for real. You are not making that up. That is right. I think I blocked that out, but you are not making that up.
Did you guys ever read any of these early stories with the X-Men? Any of the stuff from that when those 5 people were the team?
Just the Mimic story.
I've read X-Men number 1 decades ago. Other than that, no.
Yeah. And not the best villains either. We've got the Blob.
Juggernaut was the shit.
Juggernaut was a pretty big deal. And of course, that's the evil stepbrother of Professor X and its unstoppable muscular force. No one can stop the Juggernaut. Yeah, Juggernaut's cool, but you know, you got the Blob, you got the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants,
Toad,
Brotherhood, the Brotherhood, Toad. Got Magneto,
Unas the Untouchable,
Master Mold was the shit, dude.
Tell us about the Sentinels.
Okay, well, Arcade. Those are probably one of my favorite villains of the X-Men, next to like Sinister and Apocalypse. Well, fuck, they got a lot of good villains, but the Sentinels were always interesting because they are created by a man to police the streets to capture or kill mutants, and they're just giant robot that are driven by Master Mold, birthed these robots in hundreds, I guess. I don't know.
Is it Master Mold sentient, or doesn't it gain some sort of sentience at some point?
They get taken over every once in a while by some kind of techno mutant or some shit like that. I think that, you know, they did a recent one where this kid had befriended one and it was almost like a pet and it would carry him around kind of like the Iron Giant or something like that. But no, for the most part, I mean, Grant Morrison had that cool run where Master Mold was out in the forest and the Sentinels were mimicking the life forms around them, so they're like animalistic looking and bird like but with sentinel parts. I think they have just a really cool clean look. He designed them, right?
Who did?
Kirby?
Probably, but I can't say for sure because Stan and Jack left the X-Men pretty damn early. Most people point out that there's a lot of similarity between the X-Men and the Doom Patrol that came out around the same time at DC Comics, but where, you know, mutants are just like, hey, I was born with this power and it manifested at puberty. Okay, well, the Doom Patrol actually have origin stories. They're freaks who, like, they have these life-altering events as adults, and they become, like, deformed, and so they're brought together by a handicapped central figure called the Chief, and who basically uses the powers they've gained from their disabilities to, you know, help the world and kind of show that they can contribute. And that element of the X-Men wasn't really in place in the early days, but as they progressed, you had the racial element, you had the being good representatives of their kind elements, and as the series progressed, one of the main people who would write those early X-Men stories was Arnold Drake, who had written Doom Patrol stories. Most of the art was provided by Werner Roth, who is an artist that's largely forgotten. He was basically a wannabe Jack Kirby clone, but just did not have the same chutzpah, the same, you know, huevos. He just couldn't bring it like Kirby could. And Roy Thomas, of course, wrote a bunch of the stuff as well, and he was the one who really played up the race parallels, the racial segregation and oppression and the like. But yeah, it seemed like, you know, whoever was available would do the X-Men for a little while, but a lot of uninspired stories, and especially in comparison to the other Marvel books, it doesn't really pop, it seems.
Well, those are the early days, though, because, I mean, you start getting, like, stuff like the Days of Future Past and the Fall of the Mutants.
Well, yeah, but right now that's what we're talking about, cool. Early days. So, like, you know, for instance, Jim Steranko, I thought he had a run on X-Men, because my brother actually had one of the issues, I think it was issue 50, where they introduced Polaris, who was supposed to be Magneto's daughter, and she has the green hair and stuff. And I was just looking into it. He did a run of covers that ran like 4 or 5 issues or so, but he actually only drew like 2 of the fucking issues. And it just so happened my brother got one of them. And it looked amazing because it's Steranko, but a couple issues isn't going to be able to float you for very long. Barry Smith did one issue. He drew one whole issue. The big one is Neil Adams. When Neil Adams moved from DC to Marvel, he asked to be given the lowest selling books, the book that nobody wanted, because he was going to be the guy who's going to bring them up and make them successful. And he had a run of about 8 issues. You ever reading the Neil Adams stuff?
Nope.
By that point, they'd gotten individual costumes, and they definitely looked better in those suits. But again, it was late in the run. You're talking about they get their individualized suits around issue 39, and it was already like the least selling of Marvel's superhero books. Neil Adams comes in, he does some cool characters like Havoc. Everybody always really loved the simplicity of the Havoc design. It's all black, the white ribbon things that come out of his headset. Neil Adams helped to create the Savage Land mutants like Sauron. He brought back Magneto.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He brought back Kazar. Yeah, but he only ran for about 8 issues, and they reprinted that stuff as Baxter reprints in the early 80s. But again, it was only a handful of issues, and it didn't seem to bring up sales enough for it to be worth Marvel's while. I think Neil Adams went over to Avengers and did one of the grand Avengers epics, the Skrull War. And I just think that his style looks so much better on the big, flashy, you know, iconic heroes. Or on the X-Men, as hard as he tried, I think he only could do what he could. There was only so much he could do with the X-Men. I just don't think that they inspired the kind of work that you would see on the Avengers.
Do you want to clarify the Sentinel discussion? Sentinels debuted in X-Men number 14. Cover artist Jack Kirby, Wally Wood, Sam Rosen. Writer Stan Lee, penciler Jack Kirby, Jay Gavin, inker Vinnie Coletta. So, yes, they definitely created a Sentinel.
It has a Kirby design to it.
Well, but see, I was going to say they didn't look Kirby enough, but when you see them drawn on issue 14 and 15, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, it's pretty Kirby. So definitely.
I just love the fact they're just giant robots too. And I think it was one of the few villains that like Wolverine could actually slice up. They could destroy and crush and
great really imagery. Use their powers. Great imagery whenever you're fighting Sentinels, for sure.
Yeah, because I think any other mutant, they would just knock them down or throw them against a wall or wrap metal around them. It was, you know, I think Wolverine maybe sliced the blob once, but didn't do anything. So
the X-Men, again, not very successful, just kind of barely puttered along for years. Notably, after they stopped paying Neil Adams to draw X-Men comics, they went to reprints. And I think it was the first time where a mainstream Marvel book, not like an anthology title, just went full reprints. And it lasted for about 3 years, reprinting the earlier issues with new covers by guys like Gil Kane, before finally the book just full on got canceled. I think that the final issue released, let's see, it appears to have been mid-70s, and that could have been the end of the X-Men. Instead, what we got was the all new, all different X-Men. And y'all guys want to talk about those dudes?
Isn't that the one where they're sent on a mission and they die on it? It's like an island or some shit like that?
Yeah, like all the original X-Men get taken down by Krakoa, the living island. I think the only one who makes it off the island was maybe Cyclops. And so he goes to Xavier and they have to put together an entirely new X-Men team to go save the original team. And
so this like was Thunderbird, right? I think Thunderbird was one of them.
We're talking giant-sized X-Men number one, which has become one of the it's probably one of the most desired comic books of the Bronze Age.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, you know the cover. You want to describe the cover?
Yeah, it's the one where the old X-Men are in the background and the new X-Men are bursting through the cover. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that cover's been ripped so many times. It's the Gil Kane, but it's a fucking... It's like probably one of the top 10 covers of all time in terms
I've seen it. I don't want to say copies, but...
Well, they do those facsimile editions now where they actually recreate it with the ads and everything. I think they've given the giant size X-Men that treatment.
So who was in the all new X-Men besides, I remember Thunderbird,
Nightcrawler, Thunderbirds, Colossus, Cyclops, Wolverine, and Storm.
Yeah, Rogue wasn't there
in fucking 1975.
No, okay.
You never read giant size X-Men number one? Seriously,
I'm the one that brought up the fucking island. I remember reading it like one time a long time ago.
But you thought Rogue was in the book in 1975? Though,
dude, I haven't read it in years.
Ha, what a fucking idiot. Stupid.
I knew Thunderbird was there. What the cover looked like.
This fucking idiot thinks Rogues and Giant Size X-Men number one. What a fucking idiot.
I'm sorry. So, I was just like...
You're so stupid.
Hey, it was just, you know, of all the characters to be like, well, that's one of the iconic X-Men, Rogue. It's like, well, yeah, I guess eventually, but I mean,
but Thunderbird's not iconic either. They kill him off pretty fast. I mean,
tell us a little bit.
The only one
okay.
you can really remember is like, so Colossus, tell us Wolverine.
Hey, was
Storm.
Fucking Forge in it too?
Wasn't Banshee one of them?
Yes, he was. Yes, Banshee and Sunfire.
Oh, fuck you.
Banshee and Sunfire, yes. Okay, so tell us about Banshee first.
Irish or Scottish? I've never.
Irish,
okay. I always got him mixed up. I know him and his daughter share the same power where they scream and are able to float.
Yeah.
And he screams and he can, I guess, the sound waves like a banshee will destroy things.
Yep.
Isn't he just yelling Angel?
Yes.
Yeah, but he already one-ups Angel because at least he's got the yelling.
And the costume's cooler.
It is, actually. Yeah.
Cool weak span. Mm-hmm. And it was like green and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Actually, I was more impartial to Warpath. I thought he just looked cool. The Native American looked cool as shit.
Well, Warpath is way too far down the line, though. Tell us a little bit about Thunderbolt.
Thunderbird.
Well, so what's Thunderbird's deal? Tell us a little bit about him.
I mean, he was kind of the muscle man, wasn't he? Like,
yeah, I mean, he had like enhanced senses, enhanced physical capabilities. He could track. He could fight. He was stronger than average. He was like sort of like the Captain America, where he can do everything better than a regular human, but he doesn't have like one thing where he's like super duper, like one distinctive thing. It's just like he's an enhanced human, essentially.
But they had Colossus on the team at the same time, which made no sense.
He was the worst.
Yeah. And speaking of Colossus, isn't he your favorite?
Yes, Petro. Yes, I like Petro.
If you couldn't get it from the name,
he's a Russian mutant who has the ability to encase his body in a steel form.
That's what you encase. He literally becomes like throughout. Isn't he metal throughout?
I always wondered, did he become steel or did his body was his body wrapped in it?
My recollection is that he is composed entirely of organic steel while in his Colossus form. So throughout his entire body, there's no encasing. You can't pull it off of him. Down to the core, he's organic.
Because
steel.
The reason I always thought he was a case, because when you looked at his head, his hair, it was like almost like a helmet, which I just thought it was really cool looking. And he had, you know, he looked like he was made of steel. I remember him from the cartoon where he's a construction worker doing all the work. His sister's Magic, who is a new mutant who goes nut job. He has a brother who's an evil mutant later on down the line. And I remember him from the original Marvel cartoon that you could only watch on VHS that I remember watching on.
Well, are you talking about the original X-Men?
And he captures that wall before it smashes him. That's it. Mm-hmm.
I always, the segment is steel because he's got like, it's not just that he's metal, but he's got these lines throughout his body and it highlights his anatomy, and I always thought that was really specific. It's like nobody else
especially
quite looked
knuckles.
Like him.
I remember when you would see his hands, you can see like where his knuckles are at, like the joints of his fingers, and I always thought it was cool when him and Juggernaut would fight.
Yeah.
They would just slug it out.
Yeah. My understanding is the expectation, and that's why he's so prominent on that cover, they thought that he was going to be the breakout character. And if you look at the early issues of the all-new, all-different X-Men after they introduced this new team, they often feature him prominently on like splash pages and stuff. And it's weird because it seems like the strong guy, with the exception of Thing, the strong guy never seems to be the breakout character on super teams. Every team's got one, but they're almost never like the guy. But yeah, you can tell just from looking at this cover, they thought that he was going to be the guy because he was so cool looking.
Well, he's like the one in the center of the cover, right? Like bursting.
Yeah, out. He's the one pointing the way. He looks like he's the leader of the team.
He looks super badass. This is like, I don't even know if it's underrated. I mean, he's just, his look is incredible. Except, isn't the look also really similar to Mr. Sinister's, and Mr. Sinister's is even better?
I like Mr. Sinister a lot, but you're talking about 20 some odd years later. So yeah. I don't think that it's his fault that somebody decided to ape him.
20 years later? What are you talking about?
No,
Mr. Sinister was 95?
88. So 15 years later then.
No, Giant X. Well, so when was Colossus' first appearance? I was thinking from Giant Size X-Men number
one. It is. 1975 is Giant Size X-Men number one. And Mr. Sinister debuts, I think, like 87, 88 in Uncanny X-Men.
Okay. Well, that's not 15, but sure. I mean, you know, if you want to fudge the numbers a bit.
Okay, so like great. 12, 13 years then.
Okay, well, like 10 years. Why isn't it like 10? That's fine.
But yeah, I think the problem,
great
look, but I think he's so mild-mannered. I think that there was an issue where he doesn't have the charisma to get put over as the dynamic character that they were looking for.
Well, because I always, if anybody really, nowadays, if anyone thinks about Colossus, they're going to think of Deadpool 2 or Deadpool movies, mm-hmm. where he's kind of the goody two-shoe, he doesn't curse, and if I remember correctly, wasn't he hooking up with Kitty Pryde?
Yeah, that happens later on. Well, I mean, I think that they play him being kind of younger, like, you
Dude,
know.
I always maybe, thought he was at least 20, 21.
Nah, I think he's supposed to be somewhere in the realm of like 18-ish, 19-ish, which...
shit, man, look at him. Does that look like an 18-year-old?
Well, that's like he's like a big athletic guy. He's like 6'4" and stuff, so he just physical dimensions, he looks big, but he was always real soft-spoken, and he had the soul of a poet and everything. Yeah,
he was an artist and who'd like to draw naked women.
It doesn't make up for the fact that he was still romancing a 14-year-old when he was at least 17, 18. That's still too much of an age difference, but yeah.
In Mother Russia, it's okay.
I don't know what the age of consent is in Mother Russia, so I don't know. Maybe it's a different standard there. So we got to talk about Nightcrawler.
Kurt Wagner.
Another just amazing character design.
The son of Mystique. Didn't they ever discuss who his father is?
Well, over the years, they finally broke it down to where his dad, I think, was supposed to be the demon Belasco, and his mother is supposed to be Mystique.
I mean, I always love the fact that, you know, he would bamp and then teleport.
Yeah.
And I think in later
brimstone.
Later on, in later stories, they talk about how, because I always wonder, how did his teleport work? And then they later on kind of allude that, well, he's actually teleporting through a demon universe, mm-hmm. jumping in and out of this universe. So when he's bamfing on our end, they actually see him in the other universe, which I thought was kind of cool. Kind of an Errol Flynn type character. He's really in the sword fighting and...
Swashbuckling, yeah.
Swashbuckling, thank you. I remember his little miniseries where he's like on some weird flying whale ship type thing, wasn't he?
Yeah, I bought that shit. I remember that. I bought that when he was coming out.
I just remember there was like a creepy little, like a little chubby version of Nightcrawler that was running around there.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't remember that. I think I'm remembering that correctly. He's very religious in the movies, but I don't remember him being really religious in the comics.
No. That was actually one of the things that was interesting about him. And by the way, he's also, I think what's cool about his physical appearance, because being a slightly furry blue guy, he's kind of biting beast action, but yeah. he has only three digits on his hands. It's two gigantic fingers and a thumb, and then on his feet it's just like two gigantic toes.
Two giant thumbs, yeah, and one.
And of course he's got the tail with a forked tail, and so this guy grew up in like German villages and like at a traveling circus and shit, and so because he looks demonic, people treat him as though he's some sort of a monster, but he's actually a devout Catholic to the point where eventually he actually becomes ordained as a priest. But you have all these contrasts, because he looks like a demon, but he's a devout religious person, but he's also a devil-may-care swashbuckler. He's just got a lot going on.
Love them in Excalibur.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Alan Davis drew him really well.
Yes. Love them in Excalibur.
So, hey, by the way, Mac, did you have anything else you wanted to say about Colossus? I felt like I cut you off at one point.
Oh, other than the look, to me, he was just like drywall. Mm. Like, I don't have any... Other than the fastball special.
Mm.
Like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know what the hell Colossus was around for. Other than I do know he had the little thing with Kitty Pratt for a while, which it could or could not be interpreted as fucking weird. Other than that, dude, I have no. Oh, and then from Deadpool, like I don't have any other Colossus.
Wasn't he
moments.
Also in Secret Wars?
Oh yeah. Oh, we discussed that.
Yeah, I was saying,
for about 5 hours.
Secret Wars. I remember. I really remember some of the cool backstories of him in the Marvel Comics Presents.
Oh yeah, he had a series. I think Rick Leonardi drew it. I think maybe Anna Sinti wrote it.
Yeah. Well, they kind of dived into the roots of his Russian upbringing, which was kind of interesting because he does have a brother that turns out to be a really bad villain later on.
And then Mac, you on Nightcrawler?
Nightcrawler. I just remember around the circles I ran in back in the early 90s. Nightcrawler was the shit. Everybody loved Nightcrawler. I don't know anybody who was like the Nightcrawler character is really lame. Like no, everybody loved Nightcrawler. I don't know if he. I don't know if his popularity was a little before Gambit's took off, but
oh yeah.
To me, definitely before, right? To me, he was like just pre-Gambit, where he was that guy who wasn't a main X-Men, but everybody seemed to love the dude and wanted to see more of him. And again, between the look, the powers, I mean, he's just so unique. Everybody loves.
And I love the way Alan Cumming's portrayed him in the movies, actually.
Yeah, I love that performance. That was great.
Yeah.
And actually, the kid who followed him wasn't too bad, but Cummings was just so...
I mean, he had the look.
Yeah, yeah.
But Alan Cumming's, I've always liked that scene whenever he's jumping through the White House to get to the president.
Yeah.
That was, and then, you know, he uses his tail to grab the knife behind him, and then he gets shot and he drops the knife, and just, he had this really creepy look. And then when you see him later on, he's scared of the world. You know, he has those really weird tattoos engraved in his skin. So
that's the thing I wasn't too into, but you know, now we didn't talk about him either because he's not on the cover, but Sunfire. Can you tell me a little bit about that guy?
He's from Japan. Looks like a dragon. I guess you could equate his powers to maybe the Human Torch.
Yeah. Yeah. Another guy who flies around and has heat powers.
Heat powers. Yeah. Honestly, I'm not really familiar with him. I know. He had a cool look whenever the Age of Apocalypse, he looked cool.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool looking figure, but I really don't know that much about him except that he's from Japan.
He was basically the mutant Namor. It's like he's the imperious, you know, asshole who doesn't want to play nice with the team and quits them like almost immediately. And he'd been pre-existing. He was actually a guy they pulled from earlier issues of X-Men, but he didn't really take. I just want, and I think probably his biggest claim to fame is he was in a miniseries called Sunfire and Big Hero 6, which eventually led to the creation of the Disney cartoon.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Because nobody ever notices the Marvel connection, or they made a point of obscuring that. So I've been saving one of the best ones for last. We've got to talk about Storm.
Storm is the best X-Men.
Angela Bassett should have played Storm.
Angela Bassett should have played Storm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
when I see Angela Bassett speaking or in a movie, I'm like, fuck, that's Storm. That is Storm.
So like, what is Storm's background though?
She was a street kid in Kenya.
I think so. Yeah, Africa for sure.
Yeah. Survived on the streets.
Well, she was orphaned. Her parents were killed, I think, in a bombing, and that basically the walls of the I think they may have been archaeologists, in fact. And so the place they were checking out collapsed in on them. They both died. Both of her parents died. She was orphaned, and she was trapped in that wreckage. So she developed a severe claustrophobia. Yeah. And then she had to hustle as a street kid who encountered some really bad dudes. Chief among them, I don't remember his name. He was of Middle Eastern descent, but he eventually became known as the Shadow King. But at the time, I think he was like trying to rape her and stuff, and she was the little girl and such. And she pretty damn near killed the guy.
And then she was kind of worshipped as a goddess, wasn't she?
Yeah, she eventually made her way out to the less industrialized part of Africa, and because of her powers, which we haven't talked about, she eventually is worshipped by a tribe as a goddess.
And she has the ability to manipulate weather. Pretty
and
cool
fly.
Power.
Yeah.
Technically, does she fly, or does she just have like an updraft pick her up?
She can control wind, and so she basically has a cape that acts as a glider, and so she used her wind powers to carry herself.
Okay, that's what I didn't think she flew like, let's say, Superman, where she would just like leap up. She would have kind of a gust of wind pick her up, you know, like she'd do that thing where her eyes would, you know, white out and the weather would change around her and storms and clouds, and she'd kind of float up.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about her look too.
Well, which look? You have the original look where she has the go-go boots with the tiara thing and the kind of like a mini cape, or the very cool look where she has the mohawk. She's more punk.
Yeah, black leather.
That was great. I mean, she out of all the X-Men, she's always had the coolest looks. whichever version of Storm you got. But she was always the same. You know, she's, you know, strong-willed, very wise. Like, wasn't she always lecturing Cyclops? I know you said they fought earlier, but she would always kind of lecture. She was almost, and I remember in the cartoon, she was kind of the mother figure for Jubilee. She ended up marrying Black Panther.
Yeah.
Can I go back to her look?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Her dark skin with the white hair is so striking. Like, you will never, ever mistake Storm for anybody else, ever.
Well, then I think her eyes were always white, too.
Yeah, with the white eyes.
Yeah.
And then in all, like, when she was mohawked with the Marauders. I mean, I think that she's been so striking in all of her looks and through all phases of her being an X-Men that, or X-Woman. Like, to me, that makes Jean Grey even worse, right? Like, yes. Really, really, Storm is the female X person that you give a shit about. Nobody gives a shit about Jean Grey compared to Storm, right? Way more compelling character.
Yes, and I always loved the way Art Adams drew her. He drew her very distinctly. She had almost like a regal feel to her.
I feel like Art Adams draws everybody awesome. It's kind
of well, no, but I'm just thinking of certain characters, and I always loved the way he drew Storm.
Yeah, his Wolverine and Storm, I think, were probably his two best X-Men. His Beast is great too,
and arguably. It's always down to her and Cyclops as to who is the great team leader, the person who most embodies what the X-Men should be. And she's had one of the longest stretches as a team leader of anybody.
But she would, if I remember correctly in the book, she would challenge Xavier's orders, where Scott just kind of followed them like a good soldier.
Yeah, making her a more dynamic character. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember that distinctly was kind of cool, because she would ask why, and he would have to justify what he wanted her to do. And she sometimes would disagree with him, where Scott Summers, it always felt like he got his marching orders and it was his job to get the rest of the team to fall in line with it.
Well, and what was interesting with her too is she led the team after Professor X was gone for an extended period of time, and they were having some of the worst troubles in terms of persecution, you know, attempted murder against the race once again, and they were just having a really rough time. And so she had to compromise her values in order to help the X-Men get by. But the big difference is she always maintained her personal integrity, and she always made sure the X-Men maintain theirs as well, in a way where Cyclops, he completely went over to the dark side, and Storm just had a goodness in her. She would never allow that to happen to the X-Men or to herself, and Cyclops did. And I think it says a lot about those two people that's how it played out. So interesting origins of the giant size X-Men team. Of course, it was just an instance where Marvel was trying to, you know, revive a moribund property. And so initially it was Lynn Wein, the writer who's probably best known for creating Swamp Thing, and maybe one other character that's pretty well known, and he teamed up with Dave Cockrum. Cockrum had been an artist on Legion of Superheroes and had taken a team that maybe wasn't a priority of DC's and really kind of helped give them a fan base, because he is probably one of the single greatest costume designers in all of comics. And he'd been trying to do like a little spinoff team where he designed all these different costumes for them and character aspects and stuff, and DC just wasn't into it. So when he moved over to Marvel, he brought those designs with him, and so I think that's one of the reasons why these characters look so different than anybody else, because they're designed to be 30th century like rogue characters, and instead they're exploding out of this cover looking like nobody else in the then current Marvel universe.
Very interesting. Yeah, that could be it.
And also the idea that Lynn Wein brought to it was that he wanted to do an update of Black Hawk. Black Hawk was one of the most popular comics of the 1940s. It was one of the very few comics that was non-Marvel DC that actually survived the collapse of the comic book industry in the 1950s and was continuously published up until the late 60s or 70s. Eventually, DC bought Black Hawk and just continued their adventures for years afterwards. And the big thing with Black Hawk was it was a group of people that were international heroes. They were all pilots, and they all banded together to fight against the Nazis and the Axis powers. And they're all from countries that had fallen to the Nazis, so they were trying to liberate their peoples. And of course, a lot of the fun of it was, you know, you've got the German guy, you've got the Polish guy, and you got all these different people from all these different nationalities. You know, you got a Chinese guy, and seeing the dynamics of these people from all these different countries with all their little funny accents and such, which was, you know, a selling point back then, was that caricature. And to a large degree, they tried to do the same thing with the X-Men, because Storm's from Africa, Colossus is from Russia, Nightcrawler's from Germany, and then there's a Canadian as well. And it definitely replicated that dynamic. And it didn't set the world on fire or anything, but it definitely started the X-Men suddenly being treated as contenders. And I think that you can really contrast cast the all new, all different giant size X-Men against the originals, and the originals do not fare well by comparison, I don't think.
Well, because they don't have that diversity going on.
Well, that, and all these guys have kind of an origin to some degree. You know, Nightcrawler has a much more compelling story than Iceman. Thunderbird, even though they don't develop him that much, he still comes from a native reservation at a time when the American Indian rights movement was a big part of people's thoughts. You know, it was very much in the media. You've got and you know, Storm's backstory, all the stuff that she went through, and these characters just have a lot more going on with them, and they are more diverse, and they are from a bunch of different places, and we're already doing stuff before Xavier even showed up, where it felt like the students were all defined by what Xavier made them be.
Good point. I never thought about that, how vanilla the first version of the X-Men were.
Yeah, and of course there is one guy that stands apart from the rest that was also created by Lee and Wein, and John Romita, if I recall correctly, design-wise, a fellow who debuted like a two-parter in Incredible Hulk. And they,
which I read.
Yeah, and Canadian guy, they decided to draft him in the team so that they'd have that international flavor. That would, of course, be
the Wolverine.
Logan, the Wolverine.
Yeah, and I don't want to dwell too much on that guy because literally we could probably do a whole podcast on just Wolverine. And he was not an immediate success. And he kind of had the same powers as Thunderbird. What they've said in the past was that they killed off Thunderbird because they wanted to have a death to show that these guys were working at stakes that the original X-Men hadn't been. And they just felt like Thunderbird didn't have enough interesting powers to keep him around, and too much of the same as Wolverine because he's got heightened abilities,
tracking ability.
Yeah. But he also has claws coming out of his fist, 3 katana swords coming out of his fucking knuckles, and that's a little bit more distinctive than dude who runs fast and jumps high.
Yeah, I can see that.
It is funny though. One of the most distinctive things about Wolverine is his mask, the big pointy mask. And if you look at his original appearances in the Incredible Hulk, he had like a little tiny little like pointy things on his mask, but it's much more contained.
Basically, well, he had whiskers too, I think, didn't he?
On the original costume, yeah. Yeah. My understanding is that Gil Kane like misinterpreted a one design of Wolverine and gave him basically Batman ears, and then Cockrum kind of went from there with it because they wanted it to match the cover that Gil Kane had produced, and so that's how we ended up with Wolverine and his distinctive pointy mask,
which turns out to be housing his hair that's in the same position.
Yeah, that the dude definitely has. And you know, it's funny though, because did Beast have that hair, the pointy hair, before or after Wolverine did? I think before, right?
Yeah, I believe before, because he'd already become the Beast form, the blue fur form.
So Wolverine becomes one of the most popular characters in comics, and he stole his hair from the Beast,
and he stole his costume from Tigra, or Hellcat.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. Was Hellcat around before or after?
I thought we established that she was around before in a very early.
Yeah, the blue,
very,
the
very
yellow.
Early episode of the Marvel Superheroes podcast. Head back into the archive and take a listen.
One of my favorites. So we like this team a lot more, right?
My favorite version of Wolverine is Patch, not the regular Wolverine.
I'm all about the brown costume. I love the brown and orange costume. Yeah,
I always liked Patch.
Honestly, that was sort of my jumping off point with Wolverine, is when he got his own solo series. I thought that he never recovered in coolness because they started trying to reveal all the mysteries, and he just seemed kind of like one note once he got his own series, where way cooler.
I disliked it when they dived into his childhood.
Yeah, that was bad. That was a bad movie.
Yeah, that's one thing. I didn't want the links and all that. I was fine with him not knowing his past, and he could have been alive for centuries and we don't know. And I did like Patch because he was kind of this underground villain kind of character. Yeah, no, when they revealed his childhood, that's when I was done.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about X-Men is that, of course, we've been seeing the reunification of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and let's be honest, as much as we love the comic books, the way the general populace, the way the world relates to these characters is generally through media, and especially through these movies. And so we know that now that Disney has bought Fox, they have the rights to the X-Men again. The X-Men have had decades of fairly successful movies and sort of their own lore. So one of the things that Marvel has done well is they have a tendency to kind of start from the ground floor and integrate characters into their shared universe. But does that work with the X-Men? How do you think that Marvel should approach bringing the X-Men into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Should they acknowledge the other movies? Should they start with the original team? Should they start with the giant size team?
You start all over. You start with after the snap, you know, and people came back. People came back not all the way complete. Their genes are mutated somewhat. And so the children are the offshoots of everyone that came back from the snap.
So how do you explain characters like Apocalypse that have been around for centuries? You just never
use
him?
Well, that's the thing, though. Apocalypse is the first mutant, but was he really a mutant? Is he more like, you know, a religious character, like a Jesus or something, where he was always meant to be? Because he's beyond centuries. I mean, you could play up Apocalypse has been around since the beginning of time. He's, you know, a weaker version of a Celestial or, you know, something along the lines of that. But I always thought it would be kind of cool to bring back the mutants with, they came back from the snap, and all the humans that came back, guess what? Not all of them came back correct. Some of them were mutated when they were gone. And their children are the shot, you know, the beginning trend of mutants being born. That's just me, though.
Yeah, well, not just you. I think that was actually a popular internet theory.
Really?
Yeah, I think that was making the rounds for a while there. Yeah.
I literally, the day when Fox bought it, and I was thinking how they're going to bring them back in, I thought that would be the only way you could do it. Because you can't say, well, all of a sudden there's mutants, because then where were they the whole time? Like, that didn't make any sense. So I always thought that would be the only way to bring them in.
So if they're bringing them in, what X-Men do we see in that introduction?
Maybe Xavier is introduced as a child, Magneto. Wait, but see, then they don't have the same origins.
Yeah, well, because, like, I mean, you're saying you want their origins tied into the snapping.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need a Xavier and Magneto in this run. You can start off completely fresh, but you can have a Wolverine, a Colossus, a Cyclops. They're not going to be tied down with as much baggage from the comics. I mean, there's going to be a lot of pushback if they go. I mean, the only other thing you can do is like, oh, alternate universe. There's a tear in the multiverse, and their mutants are spilling from that one. But that'd be kind of, I don't know.
I think that, I think that's the only way to do it, isn't it?
I mean, if you're going to introduce from where, you know, if you're going to keep going, but I think the mutants from the Fox, they're done. Like, none of those actors are coming back. I don't think any of them want to play. I don't see, you know, what's his name that played Wolverine.
Oh, yeah, he's not coming. Hugh Jackman's not coming out of retirement.
Hugh Jackman's not going to want to play Wolverine again. He's been doing it for over 10 years now.
Shit, 20, man.
Was it 20?
Yeah.
Jeez Christ. That's right. So, I mean, I don't know.
Surely they wouldn't do, oh, S.H.I.E.L.D. forgot to mention we got another group of dudes. You know, they're not going to do that, are they? They're not going to do that. They've been there the whole time. We forgot, just like we forgot to mention Hank Pym. And then we had to, oh, nope, Hank Pym was around. Oh, we forgot to mention this. You know, they're not going to keep doing that.
Are they going to do one of those things where all of a sudden they'll play back, you know, past movies and, oh yeah, you didn't realize that Cyclops was walking in the background, or that was actually Hank Pym that was friends with Peter Parker at the high school.
Well, that's something that's worth talking about too. Another thing that the MCU's done a lot is the retroactive history. It's like, you had the Avengers movie come out in 2012, I think it was, and you know, you got Cap and Iron Man and Thor and everything else, and you sort of know, okay, well, obviously the Thor's been around for centuries. And we know Cap came from the 40s, but you don't necessarily know if there's anybody else out there. But as the things progress, we get introduced to Ant-Man, and we know that Ant-Man was active in like the 1970s and stuff. So we know that there's more to the Marvel Universe than just the guys who were there in those early stories. Well, X-Men did the same thing. They made a big deal about starting back in First Class, where, okay, the original X-Men team was back in the 1960s, and they were involved with the like shuttle launches and shit, which is actually from the original X-Men story. Is Magneto's bringing attention to mutant kind by knocking out attempts at space shuttles. And so we established, you know, obviously since Magneto was around in the 1940s, since he was a child during the Holocaust, he was in a concentration camp. So you jump to the 60s, and this is a person who's, you know, pushing your early 30s or so. And so we've seen these guys age throughout the X-Men movies, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. They've worked their way up. So can you fold that history into the Marvel Universe? Was that something we would want to do, given that that would maybe diminish some of the other Marvel characters that these X-Men were running around the whole time?
I just feel like they've already done that so much. I feel like they got to stop doing that. And now that they have all this multiverse stuff, I feel like that's probably going to be worse. Or it just is going to be, you start First Class like right now. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like Peter Parker just got his powers. These mutants are going to just now start getting their powers. And maybe only Professor X has been around for a while, and now he starts discovering these new mutants. No pun intended.
So we're starting the X-Men with the original group in 2020, for instance.
Right. Like, so the Avengers are disappearing and retiring and disappearing in time and whatnot, or becoming, you know, less effective with the Hulk and stuff like that. And so now there's not really an Avengers, and now the X-Men start to kind of come up. And then maybe some remains of the Sokovia Act is what becomes the New Mutant Registration Act in a future movie or something like that. I don't know. But maybe that's where it is. You can start them all out young. It's it's not that they've been hidden and we haven't been talking about mutants forever, but it's like it's a new occurrence.
So you want it to be related to the snapping as well, like the manifestation of mutants?
I mean, not necessarily, like, no, I think it's just, this is just the moment in time where they're at. But really, it wouldn't even be that. It wouldn't even, like, we're going to get through another phase of the Marvel Universe before the X-Men would show up, right?
Well, that's the thing. The current rumors are that they're going to sprinkle X-Men in this group of movies. It's sort of like a value-added thing where it's like, yeah, you've got Shang-Chi, but here's a Wolverine cameo or some shit like that. What I'm hearing now is that they're thinking about doing.
And okay, see, well, I mean, that's fine.
I wonder, too, I still think there's a sort of a cooling off period because, you know, Fox had contracts with these actors and with these producers and such, and of course Marvel's going to want complete control of the X-Men for their movies, but I'm not sure what contracts are still in effect, sort of like the Universal deal where they still can't do a Hulk movie after all these years because there's still contracts with Universal. So I'm not sure what X-Men stuff they can do and whether or not they can actually even do an X-Men solo movie. They might have to incorporate them into this other stuff in order to use those characters and not have to honor those old contracts.
Yeah, that's weird. Surely they got that worked out. Surely they know what they're, I mean, obviously they're gonna know what they're doing here, but I think it is probably, I think it'd be, you know what, whatever agreement there is in place, it's probably for the best, so they can have a little cooling off period before they start rebooting this stuff anyway. But yeah, I don't know how they're gonna do it. I'm interested to find out, or maybe I'm not interested, I'm not sure.
My thing is, I'm not comfortable with keeping the continuity from Fox. I think you do want to acknowledge that they've got a wealth of history, but just like with Spider-Man, I don't want to actually have that Tobey Maguire shit in my Marvel universe, and I definitely don't want the X-Men running around in the fucking 60s, decades before the fucking Avengers. That's bullshit. I'm just not into that. But because the X-Men as a concept came out early enough in the Marvel universe, the comic book universe, I do think that you should acknowledge, you know, that place as well. So my thinking is, you've got that first group of X-Men getting put together probably around the same time as, you know, Iron Man is debuting in 2008. And we don't see those adventures because these are young kids training in their powers, kind of just like developing over the course of those years to become the X-Men. Maybe a few years after. Maybe they come out after the Avengers. I'm not sure. But my thinking is, you start an X-Men movie with them in like the Savage Land and, you know, in Media Res, where they're fighting Magneto and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, and they've got fucking Kazar and dinosaurs and everything else. All this crazy shit's happening. And you realize these guys, this is a team. Boom, here's your team. You got the classic five-member team right off the bat. And so in the midst of all that shit happening, like a really cool Bondian style, just jumping near the middle of the action, then the snapping happens. And all of a sudden, Iceman's gone, Angel's gone, you know, most of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants are gone, and of course the world starts to fall apart after that, and Xavier's gone, and Magneto's gone. That's, I think, very important, because I think that those guys just so dominated the narrative of all those X-Men movies to their detriment, because I think people just got fucking sick of those guys after a while. And so those guys are gone. And so they've got the Blackbird in the Savage Land, and they like have to give the Blob a ride because they're just like, okay, well, we're not going to fight anymore. You want us to drop you in Wisconsin or some shit, you know? So they fly back to the Xavier's mansion, and since Xavier's gone and he's got all those secrets in his fucking head, they get there, they land the plane. It's like, well, this place is on lockdown, and you guys don't live here anymore. And so they got to go off and kind of figure out what their lives are going to be. And you know, several members of the team, and you know, in the case of Cyclops, the father figure is gone. They all split up. They got to figure out who they're going to be, and you know, eventually, you know, since everything's so fucked up by the snapping, everything takes a long time to get settled, like at least 6 months to a year. These guys are just like kind of twiddling their thumbs. You know, Beast goes on to college, and you know, because of the snapping, because all these people have died, they're looking for scapegoats. And you've got guys like Trump type people who are like, say, a Bolivar Trask, who's pointing at, well, what about these mutants? Maybe they're the reason why this happened. And all these superpowered people are dangers and threats and shit. And so while the Avengers are busy just trying to hold shit together with the skeleton crew they've got, you've got X-Men being like the whipping boys of the Marvel universe. It's all the fucking mutants' fault. These guys have been percolating in the background for years, and now they're fucking ruining the world, and half the population is gone, and it's their fucking fault. And so you're having all these attacks, and you're having like, you know, various evil mutants deciding fuck you and pulling shit, but they don't have the guidance of Magneto either. And then eventually we bring in Maura McTaggart, who, you know, gets to be there for the reading of Xavier's will, and she gets access to a bunch of these resources. And so they realize they've got to put a team together to help combat all these problems we're having. So instead of being stuck with a boring-ass original X-Men, you do some allusions to them being around. You mention, you know, Magneto grew up in Sokovia, and you allude to the Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch having been part of his terrorist group before they got recruited by Hydra and shit. So you kind of establish those connections, but you start the new X-Men movie with the giant-sized team, the team that people really like, except Wolverine. You got to do at least a story where after the snapping, you know, the Mark Ruffalo Hulk goes AWOL, goes on a rampage. He goes off and fights Wolverine, but since he's in the government group, he can't be with the X-Men right now because Wolverine is another guy who you have to have around, but I think he has a nasty tendency to dominate, and you have to have a reason to kind of seclude him. So he's with Department H. You get the cool fight with him and Hulk, but he's not yet a member of the team because we're focusing on these other guys, and eventually they got to get together and they fight Nefaria, and once again, Thunderbird gets killed at the end of the mission, and maybe that's how they managed to attract Wolverine's attention and bring him in. But you have them get together, you know, within a year or so of the snapping, and so you know they've got to have these adventures while everybody else is away with the surviving members and forging who the X-Men are going to be without the shadow of Xavier and Magneto, and also giving them a reason why the X-Men would matter, because they were some of the guys that were around while, you know, the Avengers were, you know, in dire straits, and gives an opportunity to acknowledge the long history of the X-Men without actually having to plod through all the fucking movies you would need to tell that tale. You can just like do little flashbacks and reveries thinking about their lost members, and of course, you know, once everybody comes back again, then you have, you know, you can basically start to reform those relationships and deal with the new dynamics of these guys coming back and disrupting the new paradigm that was created in the midst of the 5 years of the snapping. Take advantage of this big gap of years that we don't necessarily know what happened in.
Okay, yeah, I'd be fine with that. I mean, that makes the most sense, but we're still sort of doing a semi-flashback movie, I guess, in that case.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. Is it? Yeah, I guess it's still a flashback because Endgame was post-snapping.
Well, it's kind of cool because you don't necessarily know what the X-Men are doing now, too. And so you can go off and do shit with Shang-Chi without having to worry about the X-Men because they're kind of doing their shit in the blip years.
Yeah, I think that's fine. As long as I think that's a great way to do it. Like I said, the most I'm reluctant to is, oh, hey, we forgot to mention the X-Men have been around for all these years. Ha, ha, ha. Here's Sergeant Fury going, oh, there was an X-Men initiative too. Totally forgot to mention it. That I don't want any of that. So any other way, I take multiverse over that for real.
And so the thing is, what you just described, Frank, is the only way I think you would actually like the Marvel movie, and they're probably not going to do that. So
they probably
you're
won't.
Probably going to hate it. You're going to hate it.
That's why we got a fucking podcast. We can fucking have our own little continuity here for now until they decide what the fuck they're going to do. Sorry for the late release of the episode. We had a few curveballs this week. It was a little bit stressful. It all worked out, though. So, Fearless Facebook front facers include DeBash, Derek William Crabb, Keith G. Baker, Ranger Gord, Roger Preeb, Ryan Daly, and William Barrett Jr. Retweet frantic ones include Dr. Ange, who's out there on the front lines, so spare a thought for the man. Hashtag COVID Heroes. Daniel French for Spony Sound Design, and the Peruvian Day Mayor, Stephen Ray Garza. Keepers of the Favorites Flame include Alan Middleton, Batter Bally, Bakeman Says, RIP USA, No Recourse for Revolution, Between the Pages, Constantine Kotsiris, Dasha Landau, Demi, Doc Strange, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Fatima Zora, Fatime Yao Sinkara, Gay Lois Lane, Glass Doll, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, JF Davis, JMT Productions, Lisa Franklin, The List Game, who also sent us a Ben Grimm thing as a groomsman gift from the second Fantastic Four movie, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Polymer, and Richard G. And finally, the Merry Marvel Marching Society, 20th Century Geek Podcast, 108 Sage, Billy at Excelsior 73, Collected Edition, Dendroka Kalia JP, Dirk Ashton, who added, thanks RSP, Eb DeSam, Firestorm Fan, GK Wordsmith, Green Lantern HG Earth is on lockdown, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, The Irredeemable Shag, Jeremy J. Joseph, Kappa Pride Hulk, Keith G. Baker, Marvel Universe Online, who included a clobbering time gift featuring images from the 1960s, I think from the cartoon as well, the Fantastic Four one. Mike Rakitansky, Odell Abner Dracula, Paul Matthew Carr, Randy Caldwell, Resurrections, and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Ryan Daly is Waiting for Cthulhu, The Silver Cord, Slangward Scott, Stephen Kinnick, Tim Price Podcrasher, Tony Scipione, and Warlord Worlds.
The Marvel Superheroes Podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
Face runs! Lift your head! You're on the winning team!
Hey!
Cool. And see, that way we've covered Canvas the X-Men pretty thoroughly, and then we can talk about some of the movies as the 20th anniversaries come up with that, and not have to worry about going into those finer details. We can just say, hey, Halle Berry fucking sucked, right? You know, shit like that.
I'm kind of interested to rewatch X1 and X2.
Yeah, I thought we would maybe do the first three as a trilogy and just do it as one podcast.
Got him.
And whether you watched them again or not, you remember them well enough that we can bullshit about them.
I do not remember enough about them. I'm definitely
going to rewatch them too. I just don't want to drill down into one, like, for an entire podcast. I think the first three would be a good overview. Well, no,
I can rewatch the first three. Dark Phoenix, the last one, was bad.
Yeah.
I mean, bad.
Yeah.
Where I usually will watch a movie and try to give it most of my attention. I think I walked out of the room like five times.
Shit. Do we need to talk about, like, how Deadpool's going to weave them into the Marvel Universe? We don't need to talk about Deadpool, do we?
I think we got enough of notation of him during the Colossus bits. I don't want to even fucking deal with Deadpool, because that's, you know, it's popular.
But he's the guy where the actor's not going to change. Right. I think in a lot of ways he might be the fucking bridge.
I think they're going to do kind of like their version of Black Label, like Marvel Dark or Marvel. Are they really going to integrate him into, like, he's going to run into Chris fucking Evans?
I don't buy it. I think that's actually probably one of the reasons why New Mutants finally got out of lockdown, is because they're like, okay, this movie's already made. We're going to do some shit that's Marvel but not MCU. And so it gives them a license to be like, okay, here's New Mutants. This is not in the MCU. Here's Deadpool 3 and whatever else Ryan Reynolds wants to do until he gets bored or too damn old to do it. And then they'll address Deadpool in the MCU. But I think they're going to kind of let those elements of Fox play out. And I don't think you're going to see shit with the mainstream X-Men, including Colossus. I don't think you're going to see Colossus in any more Deadpool movies. I think that they're going to give them, like, the fucking dregs, like pretty much what they did with X-Force, where it's fucking Domino and shit like that. They'll give them the fucking dregs to play with, to do, you know, a sequel or two, as long as it's making them money. And then they're just going to forget that shit ever happened and do what they want to do in the MCU.
I'd like to see, like, a Long Shot and Mojo, and those would be interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think the X-Universe has a real, like, depth of characters.
Yeah.
I think that's why people got so fucking frustrated with the Xavier Magneto shit every single movie.
Yeah.
And then when they finally got to Apocalypse, they fucked all that shit up. So, yeah.
The Sinister stuff sounded, Antonio Banderas playing Mr. Sinister sounded really cool to me.
I didn't know that was going to be a thing. Either one of those would be interesting, yeah.
Like, I thought that sounded really interesting. And, I mean, they got a deep bench due to villains they could come up with. Like, you don't have to go Apocalypse. I mean,
well, and that's the thing, Sinister. Too. I was shitting on the earlier X-Men villains, because given that you had, like, 70, 80-some-odd issues, yeah, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants is all right.
You have the villains like the Nanny and weird fucking villains like that are kind of interesting.
We got to get Danny Vito to be, like, Arcade or some shit, right? Or
he's still my Wolverine. What the fuck?
No, he's Puck.
Oh, goddamn.
Be Professor X. That'd be good. Or he could be Magneto.
No, dude. He needs to be the Slug. He needs to be the Slug.
Toad? He could be Toad.
Yeah, Toad. I could see that.
Can we just...
No, I think it'd take you right out of the fucking movie.
Meet the fucking Clumps, where Danny DeVito just plays every character in an X-Men movie. Shout out to the Clumps. All right, guys. I think that's good.
Yeah, I think we're good. And see, a lot of the stuff we're talking about now would be more for the movie one anyway. So, yeah, we're cool.
The Clumps podcast. Save it for the Clumps podcast.
Right.
Clump. Welcome to Clump a Minute. We cover 1 minute of the Clumps.
It's all clumpy here. Christ. She clumped everywhere.
I'm going to go and gargle orange juice and then get in a hyperbolic chamber.